Good morning. Pleasure for me to be here this morning to talk to you a little bit from the Word of God. Some of you I've known for a long time. Some of you are new to me. It's just a joy to see old friends and acquaintances from back through the years and to be able to worship together for a little while. I want to talk with you a little bit about fearing the Lord. And I don't know how to advance this thing. How do I get the next thing up there? I don't see anything.
You just have to hit the enter button, right?
Okay, all right, I can do that. Okay, Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7. To begin with, all of these new things confuse me a little bit. My wife was sitting at the computer the other day, and evidently I had blanked out a screen that I wasn't supposed to, and she wanted to know, how do you get back to it? And I asked her to call one of the kids. They don't live here. They live somewhere else, but they can see it in their mind a lot better than I can. I'll just stick with books. I'm much better with those things. I want to talk to you about fear of the Lord. In the book of Proverbs, the first chapter, read with me verse 7. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Fearing God is the beginning of everything. And we ask advice around us all of the time. Two heads are better than one. Depends on the heads. There was a woman that remember the church where I preached several years ago. Her name was Collier. And I admired her in a lot of ways, okay? She had two daughters. They were in their early teens. Wonderful young ladies. Collier was a good woman. But like in most households, there's little friction that comes. One of the daughters could do no wrong. The other could do no right. And she called me one day and was explaining all of this, which was not the first time I'd heard it. And you know situations much like this. What am I going to do about this daughter who never respects me, who never does anything that I tell her to? And on she went. And, okay, I'm a man, and I didn't understand then, probably still don't, that when a woman starts pouring her troubles out to you, she's not asking for a solution. She just wants to vent. Well, I'm a man. My job is to fix things. So I started telling her, now, if this was my daughter, here's what I do, and I do this, and this, and this, and this. And after about 45 minutes of that, I'm done. My advice is all passed out. You can do with it what you want to. And about 2 weeks later, she called back. Same problem. And dumb me, I said, did you try what I asked you to do last time? And she said, no. And I said, well, try that, and then call me back, and hung up. That's back when you hung up telephones. You didn't click the off button or whatever it is that you do nowadays. Well, that's advice, and we ask it, and we give it, and it's worth about what you pay for it, which is usually nothing. But what I suggest to you here is that if we're reading Proverbs, this is divine wisdom, and it is altogether different from human wisdom. I've learned a little bit going through life. I haven't learned it all yet. God started all of it, and He knows everything. And His advice is well worth our paying attention to. Fear God. Chapter 1, verse 7. And you'll find it in your book of Proverbs a number of different times. Fear God, fear God, fear God. This is where it all starts. The beginning of knowledge, the beginning of wisdom, I think the beginning of really everything. And this is not just talking to us, I believe, about religious knowledge or religious wisdom. If I want to learn how to avoid sexual immorality, it's in the book. God's advice is there. God's commandments are there. If I want to deal with science out in this world, the fear of God, to me, is the underlying foundation of everything. I've read on the origin of the species a number of years ago. Darwin wrote the book back in the 1800s. And I was studying somewhat on the evolutionary theory and how it plays out in everyday life. Because it's not just scientific evolution, it's moral evolution, it is business, survival of the fittest. Well, fear God, and it'll solve a lot of the difficulties we come into from Darwin's theories. I need to have some utmost respect and reverence for God. Fear God in just about every way of life. That's the beginning of all kinds of knowledge, all kinds of wisdom, and it starts in that point. Now, to me, in a book like Proverbs, where it's all about God expressing, and Solomon, God through Solomon's expressing, here are some things I've learned, some things I've seen, and God's making sure that they're all there and they're accurate and they're correct. But fools will not do that. In a book dedicated to wisdom, to call somebody a fool to me is an extreme position, and he does that quite often in this book. Fools hate knowledge. A fool is soon angry. He's just waiting to lose his temper. He or she trusts in his own heart, hates reproof. A fool has tongue problems. And Proverbs is just a rich, rich book. And I think it would do us all well to study it. It's hard to do in a Bible class situation. But as I think Charles was talking this morning about reading through books and meditating on some of these, read through Proverbs over and over and over again. You won't learn it all the first time. When you read a chapter, think about what you've read. Meditate on it. What's he really trying to say in a passage? And then come back and do it again in a month or a year and do it again and again and again. And every time you read the chapter over again, if you've marked a verse, if you've underlined it, if you've thought about it, meditated on it, it's like running into an old friend. Okay, I know what God says there. It's His wisdom for me. And I don't want to be a fool. I want to be wise. There are just 3 points I want to talk with you about a little bit from the book of Proverbs, fearing God. First thing is the awesome majesty of God. And I can't underline that enough. Who is our God? Well, He's some being that helped write a Bible. He created the earth. Do you think about Him every day? You may. In an assembly of people like this, we will pray, we'll read our Bible. But do you really know the God of the Bible? Do you understand who He is? Really in the depth of your being. Now, we will read, or have some preacher talk to us sometime about fear God. And fear means reverence and respect. And I realize that that's at least partially true. But to me, it kind of masks what's really being said in this passage. Fear just means fear.
Am I afraid of God?
Well, yes, I ought to be. Periodically in life, we're called on the carpet before somebody. It may be a principal at school, back when principals had the utmost respect and fear of the students. We had one when I was in elementary school that had a paddle with nails in it. You ever hear about that? He didn't, but it terrified all of us. He's going to hit me with that paddle, and I feared that man. Later on in our immaturity, and this is my generation, I don't know that young people today feel that way. You get a speeding ticket and you have to go before a judge. And that man or woman sitting up there has my life in their hand, and they can do with me whatever they want to, and I was afraid. And then somewhere through life, you get over that. Well, that's just a man or a woman. They're not really a judge. They don't count for anything. They can take my license away, but I can still drive. That happens all over the world today. Do we fear God? I want to read with you a couple of passages. The book of Hebrews, the 12th chapter. In Hebrews chapter 12, the idea here is drawn from an episode that happened back in the book of Exodus, the 19th chapter. Israel has left the land of Egypt. They've seen the plagues that occurred in Egypt. They've seen the death of the firstborn throughout the land. They came to the Red Sea and they're terrified because Pharaoh's army is behind us and the waters parted. And I can't imagine how phenomenal that event would have been. We're talking about 1 or 2 or 3 million people coming up to a Red Sea And I don't think it went that way. 3 or 4 feet, whatever it takes for us to walk through single file. I think the parting of the Red Sea was a tremendous event. It was lanes wide. 8 or 9 or 10 lanes on a freeway. You're trying to get 1 million people, 2 million, 3 million people with all of their animals through here, and it's dry ground, and here comes Pharaoh, and the walls of water are mountains on either side. And they walked through and they saw that. God did that. And they watched as the waters collapsed on the Egyptian army. And they saw the horses and the chariots wash up on the seashore. Would that make an impression on you? And here we are at Mount Sinai a couple of weeks later. And God comes down. And I'd suggest to you it's a lot like being at the base of a volcano. That up top there's smoke and there's fire. There's thunder and lightning. And I read with you here in the book of Hebrews, the 12th chapter, beginning in verse 18. You people, Hebrew people, New Testament times, drawn from that episode back there, but you have not come to a mountain like Mount Sinai that can be touched, and to a blazing fire, and to darkness and gloom and whirlwind, and to the blast of a trumpet, and the sound of words, which sound was such that those who heard it begged that no further word be spoken to them. God speaks to them from this mountain. And it vibrates all the way through them. Their entire body is shaking because of this voice. For they could not bear, verse 20, the command, if even a beast touches the mountain, it will be stoned. And so terrible was the sight that Moses said, I'm full of fear and trembling. You people have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, and to heavenly Jerusalem, and to myriads of angels, and to the general assembly and church of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the sprinkled blood which speaks better than the blood of Abel. What have you come to? Not just a church service where we come together to study for a little while and sing some songs and read from the Bible. You people have come into something that is tremendous. Not that mountain back in the Old Testament that terrified you. You come to something much greater. And he ends this chapter by saying in verse 29, our God is a consuming fire. Who is God? And I think we lose that sense of majesty. That sense of awesomeness. Awesome is a word that has almost lost all meaning. To fall back in fear of some event. Had a meal a week or two ago that was awesome, wasn't it? No. I've never fallen back in fear from any meal that anybody fixed. Now, maybe some that I'd fixed that weren't palatable to start with. All full, not all some. Our awesome God. Who have you come to? Fear the Lord. He's a consuming fire. It's a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Now, the day of judgment is a great and a terrible day, depending on your preparation. A great day when we can rejoice that our Savior is coming back. A terrible day if we're not prepared. But the concept is still there. It's going to be highly emotional. We have an awesome God. In the book of Isaiah, the sixth chapter, verse 1, when Isaiah is talking to us about his call to be a prophet. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord. How'd you feel when you saw the Lord? And you have to put yourself in a situation like Isaiah was in on that occasion. And he'll explain to us a little bit, well, I saw the seraphim and they were there. And here is the throne of God and the majesty that surrounds it. And Isaiah said, oh, I am undone. Isn't that an understatement? I'm a sinful man. I'm not worthy to be in the presence of God. I'm not worthy to speak for Him. I can't imagine how he felt. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw God. And it's just in those few words. And you have to imagine what he felt and what he saw. This is God that we're talking. Or in the book of Revelation, the first chapter. And you know the verses, so I won't read all of them with you. John said, I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day and heard a sound behind me like the sound of a trumpet. Now, have you ever had one of your grandkids blow a trumpet in your ear? It'll shock you. And you turn around and look, and what do I see? Well, there is an image there. And he describes that image for us. And then he says, I fell at his feet as one dead. Yeah, I would too. To see that image of the Son of God in His majesty, this is God. This is the Son of God. It's not just some being that we look at and say, oh, God didn't answer my prayer yesterday. The awesome majesty of God, like nothing you have ever seen. And you have to feel who God is. You have to know Him from the Scripture, yes. But it's not just a knowledge that passes away in a heartbeat. Till I know God, I'll never know wisdom. And I'll never know knowledge. Because it all starts with Him. And we have to have a true sense of that. Here is God. And He talks to me through His Word. Now, second point I'd make with you is this incredible vision of God. His ability to see. We live down here on earth. And years ago, I'd gone to a basketball game at Logan School. This long time ago when it was actually a school. And we left the school building after that game, and the fog was so thick that you couldn't see more than 5 or 10 feet in front of your car. How do you drive in something like that? Well, all I'm suggesting to you is that life is a whole lot like that to me. We can look back and see things more clearly than we can see when we're in the middle of them. It's a complicated, intricate world in which we live. And I don't mean the traffic out on the highway. I mean personal relationships and how we feel about each other and how we interact with one another. In the middle of all of these intricacies of life, God sees everything so clearly. And He writes to me in the book of Proverbs, as well as other passages in the Bible, and He says, now listen to this, and let me help you out just a little bit. It is divine wisdom being given to me. God sees clearly. I do projects every now and then. I'd learned somewhere back through the years how to realign the brakes on a car. I guess primarily because we all, most of us in the county way back when, grew up poor, and we couldn't hire somebody to do it, so you just take them apart, and they were drum brakes, and I learned to do that. And then somewhere through the years, we bought a car with disc brakes, and I thought, well, I can do that too. And the pads were worn, and I bought some new ones and raised the car up, and it took me an hour and a half to do that first wheel. It took me 15 minutes to do the second one. Because everything I do better the second time around or the third time around or the fourth time around. And it's true, I think, for almost any project. My wife is a wonderful cook. When we first married, she couldn't boil beans without burning them. And the helper that I am, I would say, put more water in them when you start. And she had had home ec, and they said, no, you're boiling the vitamins out of them. Well, when you burn them, I don't care if they've got vitamins in them or not. I'm not eating that. Well, she learned a whole lot. And part of it, and she'll say, it's because our cookware wasn't as good as my mother's. And that was true, but that's not all the case there. Okay? We're human beings. We practice and it gets better. We start dating and we don't know how to be a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And by the way, and this is just a personal comment from me, nobody needs to marry until they've had their heart broken a time or two. Okay, it just kind of gets you ready for life out here in the middle. And everything's better the second time around. Well, third or fourth or fifth. We learn by experience, hopefully. God doesn't. Whatever He does or whatever He says is perfect in the beginning. When God says it, and for sake of time, I'm not going to read all of these verses with you back in the book of Proverbs, but just look with me, if you will, at some of the things we can learn. And I want to kind of start in the back of this. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 6. Grandchildren are the crown of old men, but the glory of sons is their fathers. You understand what he's saying there? And how backwards we get it? We raised four boys. And they're decent kids. They live to adulthood, which I think is grace on my part. And how those kids could have grandchildren like they did is just amazing to me. We have eight grandkids. They are the most beautiful, handsome, smartest that you've ever seen. How'd that happen? My perception, okay? Children's children are the crown of old men. We look at these grandkids, and it's altogether different, and I understand a lot of this, okay? I'm not raising them. I can bring them down here for a couple of days and spoil them and send them back home. That's my job, and I like it. I couldn't send my kids home because we were their home. Children's children are the crown. But children are looking to their father. It's a shame I couldn't have learned that 50 years ago. And they'll talk to me sometimes about the good memories of yesteryear. We loved to hike in the mountains together and we'd all go up to some place and just have a great day. And we'd do that probably once a year because I was too busy. And there's too much going on, and they've got schoolwork, and they're tired, and no, somebody's not feeling well, and we just come up with excuse after excuse after excuse. Daddy used to love it when you'd come out in the yard and pass the football with us. That takes up a whole day, doesn't it? No, 15 or 20 minutes. But I don't have time for that. Men, when we're raising our children, don't understand that the glory of children is their father. Maybe I needed to spend more time with them. Maybe they would have turned out what they turned out okay to start with. I mean, I love them, and we long for family get-togethers where all of us are under one roof, at least for a couple of hours. But do you see that God knew this from the very beginning? God says it in the book of Proverbs. Maybe Solomon is writing this because David wasn't as good a father as he should have been. There's just a whole lot here in the area of divine wisdom that we could learn if we would open our Bible and read what God says with the appropriate understanding of who God is. Back up just a little bit to chapter 13, verse 7. There is one who pretends to be rich but has nothing. There is another who pretends to be poor but who has great wealth. How do you gauge your wealth? Well, I look at my bank statement. Came yesterday. That's my wealth. No, it's not. The tangible things of this life don't count for very much. There are some of us who don't have a lot in the way of financial resources, but our life seems to be rich anyway. Happiness is not based. No, I take that back. The root of happiness is the word happen. What goes on in your life, what you have, impacts your happiness, but not your joy. And certainly not a great sense of peace, a sense of wholeness that we have because we appreciate where we are. It's similar to the concept of contentment that Paul talks about in the book of Philippians, the fourth chapter. I've learned whether I've got everything or I've got nothing, I can be content. Happy? Well, not necessarily. It'd be hard to be happy in jail once you've been beaten and imprisoned. You've got your hands and feet in stocks. I'm not happy, but I'm content. And I can be filled with a sense of joy, peace, because I'm at one with God. It all depends on your outlook, and I think that's what Solomon is trying to talk to us about in a passage like this, or in the same chapter. Verse 15, good understanding produces favor, but the way of the transgressor is hard. This translation says treacherous. We make choices day after day in life, and we'll get to a certain stage and we'll think, well, why are things as bad with me as they are? Well, because you've made bad choices over and over and over and over and over again. You're not listening to God. You're not even listening to the people around you. The way of the treacherous is hard. Don't make those same mistakes over and over and over again. Listen to God. He sees clearly the intricacies of life. Chapter 13, verse 24. He who withholds his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him diligently. My dad was good at that. I got a whipping once I reached a certain level of maturity about once a year, and it lasted a whole year. It was not pleasant. Spanking kids won't make them good. Spanking boys just gets their attention. And then discipline comes by the lessons that are taught. I'd get a whipping. Usually me and my brother at the same time, because almost every one of them was for fighting with each other. Scuffling, that's not bad. We're just flexing our muscles. But when one of us lost our temper, we got in trouble. Go to your room. We'd had our whipping. And I appreciate Dad so much now, more than I did when I was 16 or 17, because he had sent us to our room and he had let us stay there. We shared a room. We still couldn't get away from each other. And I could hate my brother. And I could hate my dad. And I could hate me. And I could just be so angry on the inside. And then he'd come to the door after about 10 or 15 minutes and just kind of poke his head in and say, I'm disappointed in you boys. That's all he had to say. Never said much. I'm disappointed. You're raised better than that. And you just kind of want to sink down through the floor. Discipline is that which makes you a disciple. It modifies your behavior. It may include punishment, but it always includes a message. Now, we can't all be wise and say exactly the same thing that some child needs to know and understand. But God sees it here, and He writes about it. And we need to pay attention to what God says, not just what the preacher says. The intense practicality of divine wisdom. This is not some theoretical book. Okay? It is practical. And let me share with you just a couple of thoughts on a couple of verses, and then I'll be done for this morning. In Proverbs chapter 6, verse 1, my son, if you become surety for your neighbor, if you've given pledge for a stranger, you're guaranteeing a loan. Okay, somebody will come to you somewhere through the years and they'll say, I need to borrow some money and I need you to co-sign the note with me. First time that happened, it was my roommate in college and he was trying to buy a ring for his girlfriend. Well, she was worthy of a ring. And he was a pretty good guy. But if I co-sign that note, it guarantees that if he doesn't pay it back, I have to. And I thought about that, and I thought about that, and I signed it. And he paid it off, and I was so glad. It was such a relief. That won't happen every time in this life. I might do that for my children. I won't do it for many people. Because this is a proverb, okay? It is Solomon offering advice. Don't do this because you might regret it. It might cost you in the long run. It's a proverb. It's not a book of law. It doesn't guarantee that every time you do this, the bottom's going to fall out of your life. He's just saying, be careful. And to me, that's the practicality of God by looking out and saying, look, you need to think about this just a little more. In chapter 6, verse 1, go to the ant, O sluggard. Observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief, overseer, or ruler. And these ants are just everywhere. And who's bossing them around? Don't they have a foreman somewhere? Well, no, they know their job. And all he's saying is, know your job Be busy about it and things will go well with you. You're laying up things for the winter. We grew up knowing things like that. We can and we freeze and put all this stuff away so that we can eat well in the wintertime. And I grew up watching that cartoon on TV about the ant and the grasshopper. And if you've never seen that, I think it has a great lesson, except the ant adopts the grasshopper. In the real world, the ant eats the grasshopper. Life can be hard. And the dumber you are, the harder it gets. And Solomon's just saying, you need some preparation for things like this. If I skip down just a little bit, kind of working my way through this, chapter 26 of Proverbs. And if you want to kind of look through some of these this afternoon or any other time in your life, or just read the book of Proverbs, you'll come across these same things. Chapter 26, verse 4 and 5. Do not answer a fool according to his folly, or you'll be like him. Answer a fool as he deserves, that he be not wise in his own eyes. Now, those are contradictory expressions. Okay? Answer a fool, don't answer a fool. And what's he really trying to say there? A friend of mine told me years ago that his mother had taught him a proverb years ago. Don't approach a billy goat from the front, a horse from the rear, or a fool from any direction. You got it? Because I think what Solomon is saying here is, if you're dealing with a fool, you can't win. Answer him according to his folly, that he doesn't think he won. Answer not a fool, because if you're talking to a fool, you get to be kind of foolish. There are times in this life, in the middle of some of our discussions, did your team win the ball game yesterday? Well, most of us had a good day. I don't know who you pull for, but most of us did okay. We want to argue about which is the best place? I don't really care. Oh, I care, I mean, but I don't miss a meal over it anymore. A lot of things in this life that don't count nearly as much as we think they do, and God's trying to get that across to us. Back up just a little bit in Proverbs chapter 18. 18 verse 13. He that gives an answer before he hears it, it's a folly and a shame to him. Now that's practical, okay? And it means a lot to me because of who I am. My personality, and Solomon, God, is saying all of these things for every one of us. The kids would ask me questions years ago, Dad, can we? And the first word out of my mouth was no. Why? Because I'm a man. I don't want to be bothered. Listen to what they... Dad, can I mow the grass? Yes. And I married a woman that in some ways is a lot brighter than I am. And she told me, when the kids ask for something, you always say yes if you can. Because the time will come when you have to say no. Now I think all of us, children, grown-ups, adults, we all need to learn the word no. It's not good for me. I can't afford it financially, morally, spiritually. We need that word no. To know what it says. But we need the word yes as well to understand that this is a great life. It's a joyful world for most of us, most of the time. But I just love the way that the Bible expresses this. 18 verse 13. He who gives an answer before he hears, it's a folly and a shame to him. Chapter 18 verse 22. He who finds a wife finds a good thing and obtains the favor of the Lord. Now, I can't just read that to you without being aware that there are other verses in Proverbs that talk to us about things like this. In chapter 19, verse 18, chapter 19, verse 14, houses and wealth are an inheritance from fathers, but a prudent wife is from the Lord. Now, this is to men and women both. All right, if I'm looking for a wife, what do you look for? Well, I want her to be cute. And that's about as far as most men think. She has to be cute. Well, no. And I'll teach the teenage class every now and then, and we'll make a list of what you look for in men or women. I want her to be attractive, sure, but I want her to be able to complete a sentence as well. Because if you get a beautiful woman that can't talk, the beauty lasts about 5 minutes, and then I'm tired and I'm ready to move on. I want her to have a great love of family. Somewhere in all of this mixture, there has to be just what I call good. Does she love God? Will she listen to Him about anything? Because if she won't listen to God, she sure won't listen to me. A wife is a good thing, some of the time. But always, if she was raised by God. Same thing is true of men. Young ladies, when you start looking around, you find a man that loves God, who will look to the wisdom of God to answer the situations of life, and that's a rarity. But here is God's practical wisdom to us. And I need that as we try to get through life today. Life is hard, but it's much smoother if we listen to God. Well, here is my lesson from Proverbs, at least one of them. Fear the Lord, because it all starts with Him. The awesome majesty of God. Wisdom and knowledge come from the Lord. All of it. If it's really knowledge, if it's really wisdom, it originates with God. Trust in Him. He will never let you down. But you have to see God as God. He's not just some counselor, not just some advisor, not just somebody who preaches to us. He is God. A Father who loves you. A Father who sent His Son to die for you. But He's also a Father that has expectations for our life. I want you to live this way. I want you to be a glory to your family, but above all, I want you to be a glory, God says, to me. Through our association together, Ephesians, the 3rd, 4th chapter, praise to God through the church. I want us to live so that the world praises our God because of who we are. Okay. If you're here this morning, not a child of God, we're going to sing a song of invitation to you to be obedient to the gospel of Jesus. He who loves you in life more than anything wants your soul to be saved. Needs to be born again by the way that God directs. Faith that Jesus is the Son of God, a willingness to repent of our sins, confess our faith, be baptized for the remission of those sins. By the one Spirit, we're all baptized into the one body. We come to be unified as we bow before God, as we bow before Jesus. But the culminating event in this process of salvation is baptism. Dead to the world, raised to walk in a newness of life. If you've never embraced the Lord in the way that He demands, we offer to you the invitation this morning. If you need to come, would you do so while we stand and sing?